Hello, hello. Welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Hope you are having a good week, enjoying the beginning of the holidays, have some good, like, cozy reading time. It's the best time of year for it. And if you're liking this book, hit the like button, let me know, and subscribe so that you can catch the rest of it. I am hoping to finish this guy off before the end of the year, so that we can start fresh in the new year. And if you're so inclined, leave me a comment of what books you'd like to hear next year. I'll see if I can get my hands on those so we can have some good new reads in 2022. Wow, this year flew by. Who knew? Anyway, though, let's get started with this one here. We're on page 191. This chapter, get comfy. This chapter is called An Afternoon Assignation. Assignation. Should look up that word. All right. After taking a quick look around, the Count crossed to the empty sitting room and entered the bedchamber, where a willowy figure stood in silhouette before one of the great windows. At the sound of his approach, she turned and let her dress slip to the floor with a delicate whoosh. What's this? When we last left this pair in 1923, did not Anna Urbanova dismiss the Count with a definitive instruction to draw the curtains? And when he closed the door behind him with a click, did he not assume the aspect of a ghost before drifting forlornly to the roof? And now, as she slips beneath the bed covers, this once haughty figure offers a smile suggestive of patience, tenderness, even gratitude, traits that are mirrored almost exactly in the smile of her former adversary as he hangs the white jacket of the Boyarsky on the back of a chair and begins to unbutton his shirt. What possibly could have happened to reunite these contrary souls? What twisting path could have led them to Suite 311 and back into each other's arms? Well, it was not the path of the count that twisted. For Alexander Rostov had spent the intervening years traveling up and down the Metropole staircase from his bedroom to the Boyarsky and back again. No, the path that twisted, turned, veered, and doubled back was not the count's, it was Anna's. When we first encountered Miss Urbanova in the Metropole's lobby in 1923, the haughtiness the Count noted in her bearing was not without foundation, for it was a byproduct of her unambiguous celebrity. Discovered in a regional theater on the outskirts of Odessa in 1919 by Ivan Rusatsky, Anna was cast as leading lady in his next two films. Both of these were historical romances that celebrated the moral purity of those who toiled, while disparaging the corruption of those who did not. In the first, Anna played an 18th century kitchen maid for whom a young nobleman abandons the trappings of court. In the second, she was a 19th century heiress who turns her back on her legacy to wed a blacksmith's apprentice. Setting his fables in the palaces of yesteryear, Rosatsky lit them in the hazy aura of dreams, shot them in the soft focus of memories, and capped the first, second, and third acts with close-ups of his starlet. Anna, aspiring. Anna, distraught. Anna, at long last, in love. Both of the films were popular with the public. Both found favor with the Politburo, which was eager to give the people some respite from the war years through suitably themed diversions. And our young starlet reaped the effortless rewards of fame. In 1921, Anna was given membership in the All-Russian Film Union and access to its dedicated stores. In 1922, she was given use of a dacha near Peterhof. In 1923, she was given the mansion of a former fur merchant, furnished with gilded chairs, painted armoires, and a Louis XIV dresser, all of which could have easily been props in one of Rosatsky's films. It was at her soirees in this house that Anna mastered the ancient art of descending a staircase. With one hand on the banister and the train of a long silk dress behind her, She descended step by step while painters, authors, actors, and senior members of the party waited at the foot of the stair. Footnote. In those early years of the Soviet Union, how did the Bolsheviks countenance the idea of gilded chairs and Louis XIV dressers in the mansions of starlets? For that matter, how did they stomach them in their own apartments? Simple. Nailed to the bottom of every piece of fine furniture was a small copper plate embossed with a number. This number served to identify the piece as part of the vast inventory of the people. Thus, a good Bolshevik could sleep soundly in the knowledge that the mahogany bed he was lying on was not his, and despite the fact that his apartment was furnished with priceless antiques, he had fewer possessions than a pauper. But art is most unnatural minion of the state. Not only is it created by fanciful people who tire of repetition even more quickly than they tire of being told what to do, it is also vexingly ambiguous. Just when a carefully crafted bit of dialogue is about to deliver a crystal clear message, a hint of sarcasm or the raising of an eyebrow can spoil the entire effect. In fact, it can give credence to a notion that is exact opposite of which it was intended. So perhaps it is understandable that governing authorities are bound to reconsider their artistic preferences every now and then, if for no other reason than to keep themselves fit. Sure enough, at the Moscow premiere of Rossetsky's fourth film with Anna as leading lady, in which, playing the part of a princess mistaken for an orphan, she falls in love with an orphan mistaken for a prince. It was noted by the savvy in the orchestra section that General Secretary Stalin, who was known so endearingly in his youth as So-So, was not smiling as wholeheartedly at the screen as he had in the past. Instinctively, they restrained their own enthusiasm, which tempered the enthusiasm of those in the mezzanine, which in turn tempered those in the balcony, until everyone in the house could sense that something was afoot. 2 days after the premiere, an open letter was written to Pravda, by an up-and-coming apparatchik, who had been sitting just a few seats behind So-So. The film was entertaining in its way, he conceded. But what was one to make of Rossetsky's incessant return to the era of princes and princesses, of waltzing and candlelight and marble stairs? Had not his fascination with the past begun to smell suspiciously of nostalgia? And once again, does not his storyline seem centered on the trials and triumphs of the individual? A predilection that he reinforces by his rather excessive reliance on the close-up? Yes, we have another beautiful woman in another beautiful gown, but where is the historical immediacy, and where the collective struggle? 4 days after the letter appeared in Pravda, So-So took a moment before addressing the plenum to approach this new film critic and compliment him on his turns of phrase. 2 weeks after the plenum, the substance of the letter and a few of its turns of phrase were echoed in 3 more newspapers and a journal of the arts. The film received a limited distribution to second-rate theaters, where it was met with muted applause. By that autumn, not only was Rossetsky's next project up in the air, his political reliability had come into question. An ingenue in film, but not in life, Anna understood that Rossetsky's fall from grace was a stone that could quickly drag her to the depths. She began avoiding public appearances in his company, while openly praising the aesthetics of other directors. And this stratagem might well have succeeded in securing her a new avenue of stardom, but for an unfortunate development across the Atlantic, the talking picture. While Anna's face was still one of the most alluring on screen, audiences who for years had imagined her speaking in dulcet tones were not prepared to hear her husky tenor. Thus, in the spring of 1928, at the sprightly age of 29, Anna Urbanova was what the Americans would have called a has-been. Alas, while the copper plate on the bottom of a priceless antique may allow a good comrade to sleep soundly, it is the nature of objects with serial numbers set down in ledgers that they may be reclaimed and put to new use at the stroke of a pen. In a matter of months, the gilded chairs, painted armoires, and Louis XIV dresser were all gone, as was the fur merchant's mansion and the Peterhof Dacher, and Anna found herself with 2 trunks of clothing in the street. In her purse, she still had train fare to her hometown outside Odessa. Instead, she moved into a one-room apartment with her 60-year-old dresser, for Anna Ivanova had no intention of going home ever again. The second time the Count saw Anna was in November 1928, about 8 months after she had lost her mansion. He was just pouring water into the glass of an Italian importer when she walked through the doors of the Boyarsky wearing a red sleeveless dress and high-heeled shoes. As the Count apologized to the importer and attempted to mop his lap with a napkin, he overheard the actress explain to Andrei that she would be joined by a guest at any moment. Andrei led her to a table for two in the corner. 40 minutes later, her guest arrived. From his vantage point on the other side of the Boyarsky's centerpiece, an arrangement of sunflowers, the Count could tell that the actress and her guest knew each other only by reputation. He was a good enough looking fellow, a few years younger than Anna and wearing a tailored jacket, but plainly something of a cad. For having taken his seat, even as he apologized for being late, he was already scanning the menu, and when she assured him that it was quite all right, he was already signaling their waiter. For her part, Anna appeared to be perfectly charming. She related her stories with a sparkle in her eye and listened to his with a ready laugh. And she was the very image of patience whenever their conversation was interrupted by someone who had approached the table to fawn over his latest picture. A few hours later, when the Boyarsky was empty and the kitchen was closed, the Count passed through the lobby just as Anna and her guest emerged from the Shylopin bar. As he paused to put on his overcoat, Anna gestured to the elevator, clearly inviting him upstairs for one more drink, but he continued putting his arms through his sleeves. It was a pleasure meeting, he assured her with a glance at his watch. Unfortunately, he was expected elsewhere. Then he made a beeline for the door. As the young director crossed the lobby, the Count was of the opinion that Anna looked every bit as radiant as she had in 1923. But the moment the director disappeared into the street, the actress's smile and shoulders drooped. Then, having passed a hand across her brow, she turned from the door only to meet the gaze of the Count. In an instant, she drew back her shoulders, raised her chin, and strolled toward the staircase. But having mastered the art of descending the stairs to a gathering of admirers, she had yet to master the art of ascending the stairs alone. Perhaps no one has. On the third step, she stopped. She stood motionless. Then she turned, came back down, and crossed to where the Count was standing. "Whenever I am in this lobby with you," she said, "it seems that I am destined to be humiliated." The Count looked surprised. "Humiliated? You have no cause to feel humiliated, as far as I can see." "I gather you're blind." She looked toward the revolving doors as if it were still spinning from the young director's exit. "I invited him for a nightcap. He said he had an early start." "I have never had an early start in my life," said the Count. Offering her first genuine smile of the evening, she waved a hand at the stairs. "Then you might as well come on up." At the time, Anna was staying in room 428. It was not the finest room on the fourth floor, nor was it the worst. Off the small bedroom, it had a small sitting area with a small couch, a small coffee table, and two small windows looking over the trolley tracks on Tiatrolny Proezd. It was the room of one who hoped to make an impression when she could not easily afford to do so. On the coffee table were two glasses, a serving of caviar and a bottle of vodka in a bucket of melting ice. As they looked over this little mise-en-scene, she shook her head. "That'll cost me a pretty penny." "Then we mustn't let it go to waste." The Count drew the bottle from the ice and poured them both a glass. "To old times," he said. "To old times," she conceded with a laugh, and they emptied their glasses. When one experiences a profound setback in the course of an enviable life, one has a variety of options. Spurred by shame, one may attempt to hide all evidence of the change in one's circumstances. Thus, the merchant who gambles away his savings will hold on to his finer suits until they fray. And tell anecdotes from halls of the private clubs where his membership has long since lapsed. In a state of self-pity, one may retreat from the world in which one has been blessed to live. Thus, the long-suffering husband, finally disgraced by his wife in society, may be the one who leaves his home in exchange for a small, dark apartment on the other side of town. Or, like the Count and Anna, one may simply join the Confederacy of the Humboldt. Like the Freemasons, the Confederacy of the Humboldt is a close-knit brotherhood whose members travel with no outward markings, but who know each other at a glance. For having fallen suddenly from grace, those in the Confederacy share a certain perspective, knowing beauty, influence, fame, and privilege to be borrowed rather than bestowed. They are not easily impressed. They are not quick to envy or take offense. They certainly do not scour the papers in search of their own names. They remain committed to living among their peers, but they greet adulation with caution, ambition, with sympathy, and condescension with an inward smile. As the actress poured some more vodka, the Count looked about the room. "How are the dogs?" he asked.
"Better off than I am."
"To the dogs, then," he said, lifting his glass.
"Yes," she agreed with a smile. "To the dogs."
And so it began. Over the next year and a half, Anna would visit the Metropole every few months. In advance, she would reach out to some director she'd known. Admitting with some relief that her days of appearing in films were behind her, she'd invite him to be her guest at the Boyarsky. Having learned her lesson in 1928, she no longer arrived at the restaurant first. By means of small gratuity to the girl in the coat room, she ensured that she would arrive 2 minutes after her guest. Over dinner, she would confess that she was one of the director's greatest fans. She would recall favorite elements from several of his films, and then dwell on a particular scene, one that was easily overlooked because it involved a secondary character and just a few lines of dialogue, but that had been rendered with such obvious nuance and care. And when Anna had walked her guest to the lobby, she would not suggest a nightcap in the Chalapin. She certainly wouldn't invite him for one in her room. She would say instead what a pleasure it had been to see him, and then bid him good night. Donning his coat, the director would pause. Watching the elevator doors close, he would acknowledge that Anna Romanova's days of stardom were probably behind her, and yet he would find himself wondering if she might not be perfect for that little role in the second act. And having let herself into her room on the fourth floor, Anna would change into a simple dress, after hanging her gown in the closet, make herself comfortable with a book, and wait for the Count to arrive. In the aftermath of one such dinner with an old director friend, Anna was cast for a single scene as a middle-aged worker in a factory that was struggling to meet its quota. With 2 weeks left in the quarter, the workers gathered to compose a letter to the party leadership that details the causes of their inevitable shortfall. But as they begin to enumerate the various obstacles they have faced, Anna, her hair drawn back in a kerchief, rises to give a short, impassioned speech in favor of pushing on. As the camera draws closer to this unnamed character, one can see that she is a woman who is no longer young or ravishing, but who remains proud and unbent. And her voice? Ah, her voice. From the very first words of her speech, the audience can tell that here was no idler, for her voice was that of a woman who has breathed the dust of unpaved roads, who has screamed during childbirth, who was called out to her sisters on the factory floor. In other words, it was the voice of my sister, my wife, my mother, my friend. Needless to say, it is her speech that prompts the women to redouble their efforts until they have exceeded their quota. But more important, when the film is premiered, there is a round-faced fellow with a receding hairline in the 15th row who'd once held Anna in awe, and while he'd only been the director of the Moscow Department of Cinematographic Arts when he had the pleasure of meeting her in the Chalapin back in 1923, he was now a senior official in the Ministry of Culture and rumored to be the likely successor to its current chief. So moved was he by her speech in the factory that he would soon be asking every director within earshot whether he hadn't seen her astounding performance, and whenever she was in Moscow, he would send an arrangement of lilies to her room. Ah, you may say with a knowing smile, so that is how it happened. That is how she regained her footing. But Anna Urbanova was a genuine artist trained on the stage. What is more, a member of the Confederacy of the Humboldt, she had become an actress who appeared on time, knew her lines, and never complained. As official preference shifted toward movies with a sense of realism, and a spirit of perseverance,
There was often a role for a woman with seasoned beauty and a husky voice. In other words, there were many factors within and without Anna's control that contributed to her resurgence. Perhaps you are still skeptical. Well then, what about you? No doubt there have been moments when your life has taken a bit of a leap forward, and no doubt you look back upon those moments with self-assurance and pride. But was there really no third party deserving of even a modicum of credit? Some mentor, family friend, or schoolmate who gave timely advice, made an introduction, or put in a complimentary word? So let us not dissect the hows and whys. It is enough to know that Anna Urbanova was once again a star with a house on the Fontanka Canal and copper ovals nailed to her furniture. Though now, when she has guests, she greets them at the door. Page 199 in the middle with the star. Suddenly, at 4:45 in the afternoon, wheeling before the count, was the five-starred constellation of Delphinus. If one drew a line with one's finger through its two lowest stars and followed its trajectory across the heavens, one would reach Aquila, the eagle. While if one drew a line through its uppermost stars, one would reach Pegasus, Bellerophon's flying stallion. And if one drew a line in the opposite direction, one would have reached what appeared to be a brand new star, a sun that may have flared out 1,000 years ago, but the light of which had just reached the northern hemisphere in order to provide guidance to weary travelers, sojourners, and adventurers for another millennia to come. What are you doing? Anna rolled back toward the count. I think you have a new freckle, he said. What? Anna tried to look over her own shoulder. Don't worry, he assured. It's nice. Where is it? A few degrees east of Delphinus. Delphinus? You know, the constellation of the dolphin. You have it between your shoulder blades. How many freckles do I have? How many stars are in the sky? Good God. Anna rolled flat on her back. The count lit a cigarette and took a puff. Don't you know the story of Delphinus? He asked, handing her the cigarette. Why would I know the story of Delphinus? She replied with a sigh. As a fisherman's daughter. Why don't you tell it to me? All right. There was a wealthy poet named Orion, a great player of the lyre and the inventor of the dithyramb. The dithyramb? An ancient type of verse. Anyway, one day he was returning from the island of Sicily when his crew decided to relieve him of his fortune. Specifically, they gave him the option of killing himself or being thrown into the sea. As Orion weighed these unattractive alternatives, he sang a sorrowful song. And so beautiful was his singing that a pod of dolphins gathered around the ship, and when he finally leapt onto the sea, one of the dolphins carried him safely to shore. As a reward, Apollo placed his charitable creature among the stars to shine for all eternity. That's lovely. The count nodded, retrieving his cigarette from Anna and rolling on his back. It's your turn, he said. My turn for what? To tell a tale of the sea. I don't know any tales of the sea. Oh, come now, your father must have told you one or two. There isn't a fisherman in Christendom who doesn't tell tales of the sea. Sasha, I have a bit of a confession.
A confession?
I wasn't raised on the Black Sea.
But what about your father, and meeting him at dusk by the shore to mend his nets?
My father was a peasant from Poltava.
But why would you fabricate such a ridiculous story?
I thought it would appeal to you.
You think you thought?
Exactly. The count reflected for a moment.
What about the deboning of the fish?
I worked in a tavern in Odessa after I ran away from home.
The count shook his head. How dispiriting. Anna rolled on her side to face the count.
You told me that preposterous story about the apples of Nizhny Novgorod.
But that story is true.
Oh, come on, apples as big as cannonballs in every color of the rainbow. The count was silent for a moment. Then he tamped out the cigarette in the ashtray on the bedside table.
I should be going, he said, and began climbing out of bed.
All right, she said, pulling him back.
I remember one. One what? A sea story. He rolled his eyes. No, I'm serious. It's a story my grandmother used to tell me. A sea story. With a young adventurer in a deserted island and a fortune in gold. Begrudgingly, the count lay back on the pillows and gestured for her to begin. Once upon a time, Anna related, there was a rich merchant with a fleet of ships and three sons, the youngest of whom was rather small in stature. One spring, the merchant gave his older sons ships laden down with furs, carpets, and fine linens, instructing one to sail east and one to sail west in search of new kingdoms with which to trade. When the youngest son asked where his boat was, the merchant and the older boys laughed. In the end, the merchant gave his youngest son a rickety sloop with raggedy sails, a toothless crew, and empty sacks for ballast. When the young man asked his father in which direction he should sail, the merchant replied that he should sail until the sun never set in December. So the son sailed southward with his scurvy crew. After 3 months on the open seas, they reached a land where the sun never set in December. There they landed on an island that appeared to have a mountain of snow, but which turned out to have a mountain of salt. Salt was so plentiful in his homeland that housewives cast it over their shoulders for good luck without a second thought. Nonetheless, the young man instructed his crew to fill the sacks in the hull with salt, if for no other reason than to add to the ship's ballast. Sailing truer and faster than before, they soon came upon a great kingdom. The king received the merchant's son in his court and asked what he had to trade. The young man replied that he had a hole full of salt. Remarking that he had never heard of it, the king wished him well and sent him on his way. Undaunted, the young man paid a visit to the king's kitchens, where he discreetly sprinkled salt onto the mutton, into the soup, over the tomatoes, and into the custard. That night, the king was amazed at the flavor of his food. The mutton was better, the soup was better, the tomatoes were better, even the custard was better. Calling his chefs before him, he excitedly asked what new technique they were using. Befuddled, the chefs admitted they had done nothing different, although they had been visited in the kitchen by the young stranger from the sea. The next afternoon, the merchant's son set sail for home in a ship laden with one bag of gold for every sack of salt. Your grandmother told you that?
She did.
It is a good story.
Yes, it is.
But it doesn't absolve you.
I should think not.
That's the end of that chapter. Do one more chapter, and then we'll be done with this section. Right. Page 203, an alliance. At 5:15, with his five waiters standing at their stations, the count made his nightly rounds of the Boyarsky. Beginning in the northwest corner, he circulated through the 20 tables to ensure that every setting, every salt cellar, every vase of flowers was in its proper place. At table 4, a knife was realigned to be parallel with its fork. At table 5, a water glass was moved from midnight to 1 o'clock. At table 6, a wine glass that had a remnant of lipstick was whisked away, while at table 7, the soap spots on the spoon were polished until the inverted image of the room could be clearly seen on the surface of the silver. This, one might be inclined to observe, is exactly how Napoleon must have appeared when, in the hour before dawn, he walked among his ranks, reviewing everything from the stores of munitions to the dress of the infantry, having learned from experience that victory on the field of battle begins with a shine on a boot. But many of Napoleon's greatest battles lasted only a day and were never to be fought again. As such, the more apt analogy might be that of Gorsky at the Bolshoi. Having studied the intent of the composer, collaborated closely with his conductor, trained his dancers, overseen the design of the costumes and sets, Gorsky also walked his ranks in the minutes before battle. But once the curtain fell and the audience departed, there would be no parade along the Champs-Élysées, for in less than 24 hours, his ballerinas, musicians, and technicians would reassemble to execute the same performance to the same standard of perfection. Now that was a life of the Boyarsky.
a battle that must be waged with exacting precision while giving the impression of effortlessness every single night of the year. Confident that all was in order in the dining room at 5:55, the Count turned his attention, if briefly, to Emile's kitchen. Peering through the little round window in the door, the Count could see that the chef's assistants were standing at the ready in their freshly bleached coats. He could see that the sauces were simmering on the stovetop and the garnishes ready for plating. But what of the notorious misanthrope of a chef? Chef! With the opening of the Boyarsky's doors just minutes away, wasn't he railing against his staff, his customers, and all his fellow men? In point of fact, Emil Zakovsky began his days in a state of the blackest pessimism. The very moment he looked out from under his covers, he met existence with a scowl, knowing it to be a cold and unforgiving condition. Having had its worst suspicions confirmed by the morning papers, at 11 o'clock he would be waiting at the curb for a crowded tram to rattle him to the hotel while muttering, "What a world." But as the day unfolded, hour by hour, Emil's pessimism would slowly give way to the possibility that all was not lost. This rosier perspective would begin building quietly around noon, when he came into his kitchen and saw his copper pots, hanging from their hooks, still shining from the previous night's scrubbing. They seemed to suggest an indisputable sense of possibility. Stepping into the cooler, he would hoist a side of lamb over his shoulder, and when he drooped it on the counter with a satisfying thump, his world view would brighten by another 100 lumens, such that by 3 o'clock, when he heard the sound of root vegetables being chopped and smelled the aroma of garlic being sizzled, Emil might begrudgingly acknowledge that existence had its consolations. Then at 5:30, if everything seemed in order, he might allow himself to sample the wine that he had been cooking with. Just to polish off the bottle, you understand. Waste not, want not. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. And at around 6:25, that dark humor, which had seemed at dawn to be the very foundation of Emile's soul, would become irreversibly sanguine when the first order was delivered to his kitchen. So, what did the Count see when he looked through the window at 5:55? He saw Emile dip a spoon into a bowl of chocolate mousse and lick it clean. With that confirmation, the Count turned to Andrei and nodded. Then he assumed his station between table 1 and table 2, as the maitre d' threw the bolts to open the Boyarsky's doors. Around 9 o'clock, the Count reviewed the restaurant from corner to corner, satisfied that the first seating had gone without a hitch. Menus had been delivered and orders taken according to plan. 4 inclinations toward overcooked lamb had been narrowly averted. More than 5 bottles of Latour had been poured, and the 2 members of the Politburo had been equitably seated and equitably served. But then Andrei, who had just led the commissar of transport to the opposite side of the room from the American journalists, signaled the count with an expression of apparent distress. "What has happened?" asked the count when he reached the maitre d' side. "I have just been notified that there is to be a private function in the Yellow Room after all." "How large?" They weren't specific, other than to say it would be small. "Then we can send Vasenka. I'll take tables 5 and 6. Maxim can take tables 7 and 8. "But that's just it," said Andrei. "We cannot send Vasenka."
"Why not?"
"Because they have asked for you by name." Page 205, middle of the page with the star. Standing at attention in front of the Yellow Room was a Goliath that would have given any David pause. As the Count approached, the giant barely seemed to take note of his surroundings. Then, without a sign of acknowledgement, he suddenly stepped aside and deftly opened the door. It was not particularly surprising for the Count to find a giant at the door of a private function in the Metropole. What was surprising was how the dining room had been arranged within. For the majority of furniture had been cleared to the periphery, leaving a single table set for 2 under the chandelier, at which a middle-aged man in a dark gray suit sat alone. Though much smaller than the guard at the door and substantially better dressed, the man at the table struck the Count as one who was no stranger to brute force. His neck and wrists were as thick as a wrestler's,
and his close-cropped hair revealed a scar above the left ear, which was presumably the result of a glancing blow that had hoped to cleave his skull. Apparently unhurried, the man was playing with his spoon.
"Good evening," said the Count with a bow.
"Good evening," replied the man with a smile, returning his spoon to the table.
"May I bring you something to drink while you wait?"
"There will be no one else coming."
"Ah," said the Count. He began clearing the second place setting.
"You needn't clear those."
"I'm sorry. I thought you weren't expecting anyone else."
"I am not expecting anyone else. I am expecting you, Alexander Ilyich."
The two men studied each other for a moment.
"Please," said the man, "have a seat." The Count hesitated to take the offered chair. Under the circumstances, one might leap to the conclusion that the Count hesitated due to a suspicion or even dread about this stranger. But principally, he hesitated because, as a matter of decorum, it seemed utterly inappropriate for one to sit at a table when one is dressed to wait upon it.
"Come now," the stranger said amiably. "You wouldn't refuse a solitary diner the pleasure of your company."
"Certainly not," replied the Count. But having accepted the chair, he did not place the napkin in his lap. After a rap at the door, it opened to admit the Goliath. Without looking at the Count, he approached the table and held out a bottle for the stranger's consideration. The host leaned forward and squinted at the label.
"Excellent," he said. "Thank you, Vladimir."
Presumably, Vladimir could have simply broken the top off the bottle, but with surprising agility, he produced a corkscrew from a pocket, spun it on its head, and pulled the cork. Then, having received a nod from his superior, he placed the open bottle on the table and retreated back to the hall. The stranger poured a glass for himself, then, with the bottle hovering over the table at a 45-degree angle, he looked to the Count.
"Won't you join me?"
"With pleasure." After the stranger poured, they both raised their glasses and drank.
"Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov," he said after returning his glass to the table, "recipient of the Order of St. Andrew, member of the Jockey Club, master of the hunt."
"You have me at a disadvantage."
"You don't know who I am?"
"I know that you are a man who can secure one of the Boyarsky's private rooms in which to dine alone while a behemoth waits at the door."
The stranger laughed. "Very good," he said, leaning back in his chair. "What else do you see?"
The Count studied his host more indiscreetly and then shrugged.
"I'd say you were a man of 40 and were a soldier once. I suspect you joined the infantry, but were a colonel by the end of the war.
"How would you know that I became a colonel?"
"It is the business of a gentleman to distinguish between men of rank."
"The business of a gentleman," the colonel repeated with a smile, as if he appreciated the turn of phrase.
"And can you tell where I'm from?"
The Count dismissed the question with a wave of the hand. "The surest way to insult a Walloon is to mistake him for a Frenchman, although they live but a few miles apart and share the same language."
"I suppose that's true," the colonel conceded. "Nonetheless, I'm interested in your guesswork, and I promise I won't be insulted."
The Count took a sip of his wine and returned the glass to the table.
"You are almost certainly from Eastern Georgia."
The captain sat up with an expression of enthusiasm.
"Extraordinary! Do I have an accent?"
"Not that's distinguishable, but then armies, like universities, are where accents are most commonly shed."
"Then why Eastern Georgia?"
The Count gestured to the wine.
"Only an Eastern Georgian would start his meal with a bottle of Rocastielli."
"Rocastielli?"
"Because he's a hayseed?"
"Because he misses home." The colonel laughed again.
"What a canny fellow you are."
There was another rap at the door, and it opened to admit the giant pushing a Regency cart.
"Ah, excellent. Here we are."
When Vladimir had wheeled the cart to the table, the Count began to push his chair. But his host gestured that he should remain seated. Vladimir removed the dome and placed a platter at the center of the table. As he left the room, the colonel picked up a carving knife and fork.
"Let's see, what do we have here? Ah, roasted duck. I've been told the Boyarsky's is unparalleled."
"You are not misinformed. Make sure you take a few cherries and some of the skin." The colonel doled out a portion for himself, including cherries and skin, and then served the Count.
"Absolutely delicious," he said when he had taken his first bite.
The Count bowed his head to accept the compliment on Emil's behalf. The colonel gestured to the count with his fork. You have a very interesting file, Alexander Ilyich.
I have a file?
I'm sorry, a terrible habit of speech. What I meant to say is that you have an interesting background.
Ah, yes, well, life has been generous to me in its variety.
The colonel smiled. Then he commenced in the tone of one who is trying to do justice to the facts. You were born in Leningrad.
I was born in St. Petersburg.
Ah, yes, of course, in St. Petersburg. As your parents died when you were young, you were raised by your grandmother. You attended the academy and then the Imperial University in St. Petersburg.
All correct.
And you have traveled broadly, I gather.
The count shrugged.
Paris, London, Firenze.
But when you last left the country in 1914, you went to France
on the 16th of May.
That's right. A few days after the incident with Lieutenant Polinov.
Tell me, why did you shoot the fellow?
Wasn't he an aristocrat like yourself?
The count showed an expression of mild shock.
I shot him because he was an aristocrat.
The colonel laughed and waved his fork again.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but yes, that's an idea that we Bolsheviks should understand. So you were in Paris at the time of the revolution, and shortly thereafter you made your way home.
Exactly.
Now I think I understand why you've hurried back, to help your grandmother safely from the country. But having arranged for her escape, why did you choose to stay?
For the cuisine.
No, I'm serious. My days of leaving Russia were behind me.
But you didn't take up arms with the whites.
No.
And you don't strike me as a coward.
I should hope not.
So, why didn't you join the fray?
The count paused, then shrugged. When I left for Paris in 1914, I swore I would never shoot another one of my countrymen.
And you count the Bolsheviks as your countrymen?
Of course I do.
Do you count them as gentlemen?
That's another thing entirely, but certainly some of them are.
I see. But even from the manner in which you say that, I can tell that you do not count me as a gentleman.
Now, why is that?
The count responded with a light laugh, as much as to say that no gentleman would ever answer such a question.
Come now, the colonel persisted. Here we two are dining together on the Boyarsky's roasted duck with a bottle of Georgian wine, which practically makes us old friends, and I am genuinely interested. What is it about me that makes you so sure that I am not a gentleman?
As a sign of encouragement, the colonel leaned across the table to refill the count's glass.
It isn't any one thing, the count said after a moment. It is an assembly of small details.
Like in a mosaic.
Yes, like in a mosaic. So give me an example of one of these smaller details.
The count took a sip from his glass and replaced it on the table at 1 o'clock.
As a host, it was perfectly appropriate for you to take up the serving tools, but a gentleman would have served his guest before he served himself.
The colonel, who had just taken a bite of duck, smiled at the count's first example and waved his fork.
Continue, he said.
A gentleman wouldn't gesture at another man with his fork, said the count, or speak with his mouth full. But perhaps most importantly, he would have introduced himself at the beginning of a conversation, particularly when he had the advantage over his guest.
The colonel put his utensils down. And I ordered the wrong wine, he added with a smile.
The count put a finger in the air.
No, there are many reasons for ordering a particular bottle of wine, and memories of home are among the best.
Then allow me to introduce myself. I am Osip Ivanovich Glebnikov. Former colonel of the Red Army and an officer of the party who, as a boy in eastern Georgia, dreamed of Moscow, and who, as a man of 39 in Moscow, dreams of eastern Georgia.
It is a pleasure meeting you, said the count, reaching across the table.
The two men shook hands, then resumed eating.
After a moment, the count ventured,
If I may be so bold, Osip Ivanovich, what is it exactly that you do as an officer of the party?
Let's just say I am charged with keeping track of certain men of interest.
Ah, well, I imagine that becomes rather easy to achieve when you place them under house arrest.
Actually, corrected Glebnikov, it is easier to achieve when you place them in the ground.
The count conceded the point. But by all accounts, continued Glebnikov, you seem to have reconciled yourself to your situation. As both a student of history and a man devoted to living in the present, I admit that I do not spend a lot of time imagining how things might otherwise have been, but I do like to think there is a difference between being resigned to a situation and reconciled to it. Glebnikov let out a laugh and gave the table a slight slap. A light slap. There you go. That's just the sort of nuance that has brought me begging to your door. Setting his silverware down, the Count looked to his host with interest. As a nation, Alexander Ilyich, we are at the very interesting juncture. We have had open diplomatic relations with the French and British for 7 years, and there is talk that we will soon have them with the Americans. Since the time of Peter the Great, we have acted the poor cousin of the West, admiring their ideas as much as we admired their clothes. But we are about to assume a very different role. Within a matter of years, we will be exporting more grain and manufacturing more steel than any other country in Europe, and we are leaps ahead of them in ideology. As a result, for the first time, we are on the verge of taking our rightful place on the world stage, and when we do so, it will behoove us to listen with care and speak with clarity. You would like to learn French and English? Osip raised his glass in confirmation. Yes, sir, but I don't simply want to learn the languages. I want to understand those who speak them. And most importantly, especially, I would like them to understand their privileged classes, for that's who remains at the helm. I would like to understand how they view the world, what they are likely to count as moral imperative, what they would be prone to value, and what to disdain. It is a matter of developing certain diplomatic skills, if you will, but for a man in my position, it is better to foster one's skills discreetly. How do you propose that I help? Simple. Dine with me once a month in this very room. Speak with me in French and English. Share with me your impressions of Western societies, and in exchange... Glebnikov let his sentence trail off, not to imply the paucity of what he could do for the Count, but rather to suggest the abundance. But the Count raised a hand to stay any talk of exchanges. If you are a customer of the Boyarsky, Osip Ivanovich, then I am already at your service. All right. And we'll stop there.